desires. Wash away the negative habit energy and examine the defects of worldly excitement. Hold on to the awareness of the Atman and leave at once your own limited identity. Let us now take up the verse number 2. We'll read the Sanskrit as we did yesterday. If you want to join me in chanting, you're welcome. Verse number 2. Sangasatsu vidhiyatam bhagavato bhaktir dridhadhiyatam shantadif parichiyatam dridhataram karmashu santyajyatam satvidvanupasarvyatam pratidinam tatpaduke sevyatam brahmaikaksharamarthyatam shrutishiro Vakyam samakarnyatam. The translation: remain in the company of the holy and strengthen your devotion to God. Cultivate the qualities such as self-restraint and give up all work prompted by selfish desire. Approach those who are wise and holy and serve them. Seek only the imperishable being and hear the words of the scripture. So let's take up these things one by one. Remain in the company of the holy. In spiritual life, a holy company has always been considered a very important and helpful practice. Which is why we know that when we were children, our parents told us, and now that you are, many of you are parents, you tell your children and your grandchildren the importance of being in good company. Having good friends. Sometimes it is said, you tell me who your friends are and I'll tell you who you are. And we know therefore that the kind of circles we move in profoundly influence our thoughts. Actually, we are all influencing each other all the time. It's not that we are being influenced by others, but we are also influencing others. And the question is, who influences whom? Or whose influence is stronger? That is to say, if, let's say, a good person is in a company of whom we may call a bad person. So obviously, the good person's good influence will fall on the bad person, and the bad person's bad influence will fall on the good person. And who will succeed in that kind of an exchange? And the answer to that is, it depends on the strength of your influence. That is, if a good person says in the company of an evil one, and my goodness is not stronger than his or her wickedness, then obviously that wicked influence is going to overpower my goodness. On the other hand, it's possible that my goodness is stronger than the wickedness of that person, in which case I will be able to influence that person. So in spiritual life, in general, it's always a good practice that we should be eager to get holy company, but don't go out of your way to give your holy company to others. I say that because until our own holiness becomes strong enough, we cannot be too sure whether I can say, well, now I'm leading a spiritual life, so let me now go and influence others and help them, which in itself is a wonderful motive. That is in fact a great act of service. Service does not mean simply giving food to the hungry, but also bringing some hope and cheer in the lives of others. But the trick to that is, if my holiness or goodness is not strong enough, then if I'm eager to go and reform other people, it's possible that their wickedness is stronger than my holiness. So instead of my changing them, the opposite may happen. So seek holy company. Don't be eager right in the beginning to give your holy company. If there is any goodness in us, we'll automatically influence others. We don't have to make an extra effort to do that. Now, of course, the question always is, we might say, well, now, where do I go in search of holy people? It's not like they are a dime a dozen available everywhere. And so we might say, well, I want holy company, but I don't particularly see a lot of holy people around me. And now company here, of course, does not mean simply holy people. Being in the company of holy thoughts, and holy thoughts can come through reading holy books, doing holy things, anything that would produce holy ideas in me, which could be through, for instance, in India they have one channel, what is that, Astha. There is one channel called Astha channel, which has only religious programs. So there could be some programs on even television which have spiritual content. And that's wonderful. Or do you read some holy books? So books, having holy books as a company is also a wonderful thing in the absence of a company of holy people. And that is how our devotion to God can be strengthened. You see, we human beings, our minds are very impressionable. We tend to absorb whatever comes. And especially when we are young, which is why we have to be so careful that the right kind of influences come to the growing generation. And that is why the importance of holy company. Cultivate the qualities such as self-restraint. In many Vedanta texts, they say, first of all, they say there are four basic practices. If we want to be spiritual, the four practices described in the books are, first, it is called Viveka. Viveka means the ability to look deeply and then distinguish what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad, what is eternal and what is not eternal. Because first of all, we don't look deeply into things, which is why a lot of decisions we take in life are mistaken, are not good for us. So first of all, look deeply. That is called Viveka. The second quality necessary is called Vairagya. Vairagya means detachment or dispassion. And that is connected with Viveka. If I look deeply into something, and then I know exactly this is the right thing and this is the wrong thing. Then, of course, the next thing is I must keep away from the wrong thing and hold on to the right thing. That is called Vairagya. And third step is called, it's a collection of six treasures. In texts, oftentimes it is called Shat Sampatti. Sampatti means a treasure. Shat is six. So Shat Sampatti means six treasures. And they are described in books as, the first is called Shama. Shama means control of mind. Dhamma means control of our senses. Uparati. Uparati means every time the mind wanders away from the ideal, to drag the mind back to our ideal. Then Titiksha. Titiksha means forbearance. Forbearance is a great quality. Holy Mother Sharada Devi used to say that forbear, forbear, forbear. We know that in life, however much all of us would like to have things go exactly the way we want them to go, we know that it never happens in life. Some things go exactly as we want them to go. Some things don't. But that's how life is. Some things happen according to plan. Many things don't happen according to plan. When something happens exactly the way we want it, we are happy. But what about those things which happen not the way we want it? What do we do when we have forced to be in the company of people who are very disagreeable, who are obnoxious, and there is no way of avoiding that company? Someone said, God gave me my relatives, thank God I can at least choose my friends. So at least for friends we have some choice. We can choose and say, well, okay, I have nothing to do with you. We can stop our friendship. But with some of our close relatives, you can't do anything. They are just there. And it's not necessary that always all our family members are always very agreeable and nice. It's not. Some in every family you will find there'll be somebody in the family who's not so. You are not able to get along well with that person, but neither can you avoid that person. Then what do you do? And say, forbear. Forbearance means, Shankaracharya gives a beautiful verse. There is a book called Viveka Chodamani. In that, there is a nice one verse which says, he defines titiksha, forbearance. The verse goes like this. Sahanam sarvadukhanam apratikara purvakam chinta vilaparahitam sa titiksha nigadyate. It means, sahanam sarvadukhanam, bearing all afflictions, all pain, all suffering, apratikara purvakam, without resisting, chinta vilapa rahitam, without grumbling, sa titiksha nigadyate. So oftentimes what happens is we do bear pain, oftentimes because there is no choice. But we don't do it gracefully. You're always kind of either mad at it or just complaining, oh, this person is like that, it's so terrible, and so on. So then, it doesn't help us. We are not able to keep our own peace of mind. We feel stressed out. So that kind of situation can be turned to our advantage by practicing forbearance in the right way. And forbearance means accepting things as they are. Not trying to deny, not trying to, something is terrible and just pretending, oh no, it's all fine. It's not pretension. Just recognizing, oh yeah, it is terrible. But also recognizing that that's a part of life. Bearing it without complaining, without grieving. What that kind of thing does is it makes us strong. Oftentimes we think if we keep on grumble and complain, we are kind of venting out. We are kind of just, we feel that we feel kind of relieved if we are just going, go and just tell some close friend and say nasty things about somebody whom I don't like. But that makes me weaker. But if I'm able to absorb all the problems around me without complaining, it's not easy. But if I'm able to do that, it makes me stronger. And such a person becomes fit for spiritual life. For instance, now if there's a big snowstorm, and it's possible to say, oh, what a terrible day, and it's hopeless, and what kind of a place I've come to, it's only snowing all the time. If I'm just going to be complaining all the time, then of course, as a spiritual seeker, that day is ruined. I can't think of God, I can't do anything, because I'm just mad at weather. But if I'm just able to accept situation as it is, then no matter whether it is sun or rain or what, I can still remain focused and do the things I need to do. So forbearance is an important quality in spiritual life. Titiksha, then samadhana. Samadhana means contentment. It also means focusing the mind on what needs to be done. That's important also. And shraddha. Shraddha means deep faith. In spiritual life begins with faith. It doesn't have to end in faith. It begins with faith. We need faith because spiritual life is about a transcendent reality, about God. And unless we have faith that there is some being, some power, some reality, someone there, out there who is God, how can we even pray? Our prayer will not be meaningful until we are sure that somebody is there listening to my prayer. It's like, you see, when you pick up a phone and you call somebody, we need even faith to make a phone call. Because when you pick up the phone and should have the faith that the other person is still holding the phone in hand, not simply kept the phone and gone to do some work. When I say something, I'm hoping, expecting that the person on the other side of the line is listening to me and would respond. If I'm not sure that the other person is there, then I won't feel like speaking. So we expect, if the other person is totally silent, over the phone we sometimes say, are you there? Then the person, oh yeah, listening, I'm listening, continue. Now with prayer, the problem is, it's like a one-sided conversation. You pray to God and say, are you listening? And of course, there is no response. And then you say, well, is someone out there on the other side? So that is where we need faith. That yes, God is there, God is listening, and God will respond. Now, this faith is necessary to begin with, because we don't begin our spiritual life with an experience of God. If you have already had an experience of God, then you don't need faith. You see, for instance now, I'm able to see all of you sitting here. I don't need, I have faith that all of you are sitting. But I can say, I have faith that you are listening to me. Because you may be sitting in front of me, but maybe thinking of something else. There I need faith, because I don't experience whether you are listening. But that you are sitting in front of me, I don't need faith, because I'm seeing you. So similarly, when we have a direct experience of God, then we don't need faith that God is there, because we already experienced God. But until that first experience comes, we need faith. That is why even the, and you see that this is nothing terribly Vedantic about it. It's a very universal thing. Even in Christian theology, the three cardinal virtues are called faith, hope, and love. And that's again a very universal formulation. So spiritual life begins with faith. If there is faith, then hope grows in the heart. Because then I can say that the spiritual practice that I am doing will yield some result. There will be some hope. And when there is hope, it matures into a genuine spiritual experience. And then that produces real love in the heart. All the three are connected. And so therefore, when it is said here, the qualities such as self-restraint, all these six qualities are included in that. And give up all work prompted by selfish desire. What does work do? There is a chain reaction described in Vedanta. What exactly happens is this. And some of you, does any of you follow Sanskrit here? Okay, well, it's like this. The chain reaction is this. Avidya, kama, karma, janma, dukkha. It begins with ignorance. All the whole worldview presented here begins with ignorance. Ignorance of who we really are. As I pointed out to you yesterday, the truth is that we are all divine. We are perfect. Every one of us is perfect. Every one of us is immortal. Every one of us is already free. That's the reality. Now, of course, we have forgotten that reality. And because that reality is forgotten, we have begun to think of ourselves as just the opposite. In reality, we are immortal. And now we say, I am mortal. That is why the thought of birth and death come in our mind. Reality, we are all perfect. But we don't feel. Some people feel they are perfect, but they are not. So we feel, deep down we all know we have our imperfection. And of course, we know we are ignorant. We know that there are a lot of things in life we don't know. So it is this ignorance that produces desire. What is desire? Desire really means, desire obviously means a want. And we desire only that which we don't have. Now the truth is, if we are perfect and free, there is nothing that we don't have. We really have everything. We are purna, we are whole, we are full. But because of that ignorance, we always feel that we are lacking in something. And therefore, anything that we lack, we desire. May I have this? I should have that. I should have that. Because I feel I'm somehow not complete without something. If already we feel I'm completely contented, I don't need anything at all, then there shouldn't be any desire. But because we have that sense of incompleteness, we desire. Now it is desire, avidyaya, kama. Kama is desire. Then, kama produces karma. Once I feel the lack of something and I desire something, that prompts me to action. So now, I feel life would be disastrous without chocolate. And so desire for chocolate comes to me. As soon as that desire comes, of course, then the next thing is to do some action to go and bring that chocolate. And so, of course, I get up and go open my refrigerator, take out that chocolate, okay? And then I eat it. So, some karma was done. Once you do some action, the action will yield its result. Of course, here, fortunately, if you like chocolate, you eat chocolate and the immediate result is it brings you joy. And the result is done. But we find there are a lot of things we do which don't yield immediate results. Actions are of many kinds. Some actions yield quick results. Some actions we know. You now, suppose you are studying for your exam. You finish your exam, the results don't come immediately. It takes a while for them to come. There are certain other things you do. For instance, if you now plant a seed, the tree doesn't grow overnight. Sometimes it may take years before a tree comes. So some of the actions produce immediate results. Some of the actions take years. Some of the actions we don't see the results at all in this life. And then of course we felt, well, if it is not in this life, then it should be next life. Or any kind of a postmortem existence, which is why people say, even the cat has come to listen, which is why people say that if you do well now, then you will go to heaven. You will be with the Lord. Well, what is it? It's that if I do something good now, the result of this action will not be immediate. Just imagine, if we were told, you do something now, you will be with the Lord right now. Many people will not be in a hurry to do something good. We all want to go to heaven, but not yet. You see? So while going to heaven seems like a good goal, none of us is, frankly speaking, none of us is in a hurry to go there. And so, and therefore, we say that you do something good and you will be in the Lord's presence right now, we would say, okay, then let me postpone it for a while. The only reason we do good is we are told, after you die, you'll go to heaven. So we say, well, I still have some time here. So we know, therefore, that there are certain actions we believe which will have the result after we die. Now, the trick is this. What these thinkers said, that any kind of work will yield only two kinds of result, really, essentially. That if the work is either a success or a failure. If it's a good work, it will yield good results, which means it will be going to make me happy. It's going to bring me joy or sukha in some way. If it's a bad work, it's going to bring me dukkha or pain or sorrow in some way. And that gets mythologized in the form of two places. Heaven seen as a place of joy, and hell seen as a place of pain and sorrow. But whether we have to experience joy or sorrow, we all need the body. It's very clear that without a body and mind, we cannot experience joy or sorrow. So that is very a requirement. Now, as some of you who were present yesterday, may remember, we said that while the body is wonderful, the mind is a wonderful equipment, and my body is a wonderful equipment, we know that neither of these is perfect. Both of these have their limitations. And the body, of course, the basic limitation we have seen is it's the periodic breaking down of the body, we call illness or disease, the process of aging, which is not pleasant by any means, and of course the reality of death. There is no living body which is free from these realities. Same with the limitations of the mind. So, ignorance produces desire. Desire prompts us to action. Action will yield results in the form of joy or sorrow. In order to experience joy and sorrow, I need a body and mind. And body means mortality, body means illness, body means disease, body means all these limitations. And the whole point of spiritual life is transcend these limitations. So if I now continue this circle, desire, action, results, body, limitations, and this, I want to get over the limitations, and again I go to desire, then I'm never ever going to go above these limitations. Which is why this verse says, give up all work prompted by selfish desire. Because as long as these desires are there, I am still trapped in this vicious circle, the circle of samsara. And if I want to get out of this circle, then the way out of this circle is not through desire, but we're trying to minimize our desire. A person, the happiest person in the world, is not one who has billions of dollars or one who has wields a lot of power. The happiest person in the world is one who doesn't have any want, who doesn't have any desire. And don't think that just if I have lots of money, I will not have any desire. There is absolutely no connection. It's possible to have lots of money, and in fact, the desires may grow even more after that. And so how much wealth we have or how much power we have is no relation at all to how much desire we have. These are completely separate things. And if we want to be happy, we need to minimize. And one simple way to do that is really is to ask ourselves, anytime a desire comes for something, I must have it. Really ask yourself, do I really need it? Can I really live without it? And you can see, one of our Swamis used to say that depending on how distant the journey is, it depends on how much luggage you can take. If you're traveling by train, the maximum luggage you can take is a certain amount. If you're traveling by plane, of course, it's still less. If you are being an astronaut and going to the moon or something, then you can take even less luggage. Even your food will go in like a capsule form. So the further you have to go, the longer the distance, the lesser the luggage you have, the more comfortable the journey. Otherwise, most of the time you're wondering, oh, where are my bags? And I've checked in the bag and is it missing? Then go to the baggage claim. But suppose you just have a carry-on. Then you don't have to worry. Just simply walk out to the airport. So the minimum baggage we carry, the happier the journey it is. Now this journey of life, how much baggage we are all carrying. And so all of our energy and time in this journey of life is just trying to keep, all my things are okay or not. And the more you have, the more there is a fear of losing it. So the less you have, the happier you are. So that is the idea behind this, what desire can do. So approach those who are wise and holy and serve them. So serving the holy has always been considered a very helpful practice. And there are enormous stories in the lives of saints, etc., how those who served them benefited spiritually through their grace and teaching that they received from their teachers. Seek only the imperishable being and hear the words of the scripture. If we seek perishable things, we will get perishable results. If we want eternal results, results which don't end quickly. I mean, we all want joy in life. It's not that we don't have joy. Of course, we now and then we do get bits of joy every day, really. But that joy kind of comes and goes. But when we say, I want to be happy, what we really mean is, I want the kind of happiness that will never end. When I say that I don't want pain and sorrow, it's not like we are all the time in pain and sorrow. Clearly not. There are times in our life, there is no pain and sorrow. But there are times when there is. So when I say that I don't want pain and sorrow, what we really mean is, I want to be permanently free from pain and sorrow. And I want a state in which I can be permanently happy. Now the trick to that is, if I want something which is permanent, only that which is permanent can give me that result. What we make the mistake of doing is that it is in the impermanent things that we seek the permanent results. And none of the perishable things of this world can give me the imperishable joy that I seek. And God alone is the imperishable being. Everything else in life will be destroyed. Everything else in life will change. The only unchangeable being, the only indestructible reality, the only eternal being is God. And only God can give me what I want. That's why it is said, seek only the imperishable being and hear the words of the scripture. Because in matters of transcendental reality, the scripture is our only guide. The role of scripture is, it will be discussed in the next verse, is scripture is not something that we need to follow blindly. Not that you say, oh, just because the scripture says it, believe it and don't ask any questions. That's not the point. The point is, are we even, that's where faith comes in. Why would I even feel like reading a scripture unless I have faith that it has something in me, in it, which is helpful to me? Otherwise, I wouldn't even open the book. So, the fact that we are investing some time and energy in reading a book implies that at least there is some basic faith that it has something which could be helpful to me. Now, what these teachers recommend is not that accept the scripture without questioning. What they say is, be accept it at least as a working hypothesis. That accept that there may be truth in it. Try to follow what the scripture says. And after following, if you don't see any results, you have full right to just throw away the scripture. I mean, you don't have to accept it. But you, it's not even scientific to reject something without trying it out. That is what these sages have said. None of them say that just believe what is in the book and that's it. No, they say, here is a book, see what it says, give it a try, practice according to it. And after practicing, if you find, no, it doesn't work, okay, then you can discard it. So we should not discard something without giving it a fair trial. That is what is meant by hear the word of the scripture. And what is the attitude over that? We'll see in the next verse. So we'll quickly go through the next verse, and then if you have any questions and doubts, we can deal with that. So verse number 3. Vakyarthascha vicharyatam shrutishirah pakshas samashriyatam dustarkat suviramyatam shrutimatas tarkonusandhiyatam brahmaivasmi vibhavyatam aharahar garvah parityajyatam deheham matirujyatam budhajanair vadav parityajyatam. Let me read the translation now. Reflect over the meaning of the scripture and take refuge in its perspective. Keep away from vain arguments and follow the reasoning of the scripture. Always be aware that you are Brahman and completely give up all egoism. Eliminate the thought of I connected with the body and don't argue with the wise ones. Reflect over the meaning of the scripture. So there are three basic practices in Vedanta. And that is, they are called in Sanskrit, Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. Shravana means listening. First thing to do is, of course, listen. Listening is an art. Not everybody can listen. It's like this. What is the, when there is a group, like all of us are sitting here, and there is a group discussion. What is the opposite of talking? No. Generally, in a group discussion, the opposite of talking is waiting. What happens is, there are 10 people discussing something, and one person is talking. Most of the others are not really listening. They are thinking in their mind of what they want to say. And they're just waiting. As soon as this fellow stops, I'm going to jump in and say something. So very few people really listen. So a dialogue or a conversation means one person listens, one person speaks, the other people listen. After listening, when they have some thoughts, then they share. That yields to some really fruitful conversation. But oftentimes what happens is, I mean, there are 10 people sitting, there are 10 monologues. I'll say something and then nobody really responds to what I'm saying. Because they have already thinking in their mind now what they have to say. And then somebody says something and somebody's... And at the end of that big discussion, you come up with like, what have I learned? Nothing. So listening is an art. Listening involves that I must have the ability for a time being to stop cluttering my mind with my own wise ideas and just listen. Then, of course, it's not that just because I listen something, I have to accept it. Listening and accepting are two different things. I can give a very respectful listening to the other person and totally disagree with that other person. So listening is important. So that is the first practice, Shravanam, listening. The second is Mananam. So after you listen, then you have to reflect. See, oftentimes the scriptures, the words of the scriptures are such, the meaning, the inner meaning of that scripture may not become apparent at once. So oftentimes we need to think. Now the Vedanta text will sometimes will say, you are perfect, you are immortal. You know, you just listen to it and say, you know what, doesn't make sense. Oh, I don't feel I'm immortal. I'm very much a mortal being. I don't feel I'm perfect. I'm very imperfect. Then you need to reflect. How is this, in what sense am I being told that I'm immortal or I'm perfect? So certain of your doubts will be overcome when you start reflecting over the scripture. Some doubts will still continue to be. Then the third step comes in called Nididhyasanam. Nididhyasanam means a deep contemplation on these truths. Then whatever remaining doubts will also go away. That is what needs to be done. That is what is meant here by reflect over the meaning of the scripture and take refuge in its perspective. What is the meaning of take refuge in its perspective? Each thought, each text presents us with a perspective. And we need to look at the insights presented there from the point of view of that perspective. Because if we just come from a different direction and just start questioning everything, that doesn't help at all. What we need to do is have healthy skepticism. Don't accept anything blindly. But that doesn't mean just argue for the sake of arguing, question for the sake of questioning. That might seem like, oh, I'm being very rational about it. But at the end, when you go home and say, well, what has this rationality finally given me? Nothing, just emptiness. So that's what we want to gain something from this study. So take refuge in its perspective means try to look at these truths from the perspective offered by the scripture. Retaining with you the freedom at any given moment to reject it totally. Nobody's taking away that freedom. You can keep away the book whenever you want. But before you keep away, try to look at it from the way it wants us to look at it. That's what is meant by take refuge in its perspective. Keep away from vain arguments. In Sanskrit, there are actually different names for the different kinds of arguments. It's called vada, vitanda, and so on. What it essentially means is this. When two people argue, the motivation behind every argument is not same. Let's say, now here are these two fellows who are arguing. One way to argue, one reason for arguing is to arrive at the truth. You have that idea, I have this idea. So I listen to what you have to say carefully, respectfully, granting that there may be some truth in what you say. And then I listen to you and then I say, you know what? At this particular point, I don't agree with because this is my idea about it. Then the other person listens and says, but I feel this about it. And this way, this would lead to something constructive. When we express to each, we listen to each other's perspective and then say what we have to say. And that is a very healthy argument. There's a second kind of argument, in that is, I don't listen to you at all. My only goal in that argument is to make you see that I know the truth. And so if both of them are doing the same thing, they are just talking past each other. That really doesn't help. A third kind of argument is, I really don't have anything to say, but I'm determined to tell you that you are wrong. So you know, there are many different reasons. So when two people are arguing, don't immediately imagine that something constructive is going to come. Because it all depends on the individual attitudes and motivations of the people involved in that argument. And that is what is meant here by saying, keep away from vain arguments. Those kind of arguments do not help us in spiritual life at all. So these remember, this hymn is for those who take spiritual life seriously. This is not, this will not be helpful for a Sunday religion. By Sunday religion means confining religion to just one day in life. Say, okay, I'm interested in politics, I'm interested in sports, I'm interested in, and it's good to have a little bit of interest in religion also to kind of make life full. Now, for such people, this really will not make sense, because if religion, we want the place of spirituality in our life, we're just kind of adding a little bit of a flavor to our life to make us feel I'm not entirely neglecting God. I just kind of feel my conscience a little bit. Then we don't need to study this. But this text is meant for those for whom spirituality is we are serious about it. That we realize that it has a deeper underlying purpose behind it. That it is not merely just one small aspect of my life. That this is an underlying purpose of my life. That just as I recognize I need food for my survival, just as I recognize I need healthy ideas for my survival of my sanity of mind, similarly, I need the presence of God for my spiritual survival. So those who take spiritual life seriously, for them, all this will make sense. So these vain arguments about spirituality and God do not help our spiritual life. And follow the reasoning of the scripture. This is similar to what I said about take refuge in his perspective. See the logic given in a scripture. See whether it makes sense. First of all, see whether it makes sense intellectually. And next, try to practice it and see whether it actually yields the result. And as I said, if it does not yield the result, you have complete freedom at any given stage to say, I reject it. But don't reject it before giving it a try, because otherwise you may be throwing away something which could be useful. Always be aware that you are Brahman and completely give up all egoism. The most important thing in life is to hold on to our identity. You see, it's like this. Now there are, of course, a lot of different kind of credit cards available. We know that different kind of credit cards give different advantages. Some will give more miles and some will do this and so on. And so we keep on sometimes juggling between different cards. We may sometimes find that a certain card is more useful. It kind of gives me a lot of benefit. And so eventually we may find that we keep on using one card more than the other cards. Our identities are a little bit like that. We have many different identities in life. We have multiple identities in life. One common identity we share, of course, is the human identity, that I am a human being. So suppose we go to a zoo and we find all different kinds of animals, then although we don't speak with them, but at least we are just saying, I am a human being. You are a monkey, you are a lion, but I am a human being. So then there, of course, our human identity becomes more apparent. But when we are all human beings sitting together, we don't have to tell each other, I am a human being. It's kind of pretty obvious. But then we have other identities. Then we have a national identity. I am of an Indian origin. I am an American. I am an Egyptian. I am a so-and-so. Then we have our gender identity. We say, I am a man. I am a woman. We have our cultural identity. We have our racial identity. Then we have our political identity. I am a Republican or a Democrat. Then we have our sport identities. What does the Iowa have any good team?
Hawkeyes.
I'm sorry, I don't even know the name because I am so caught up in our Red Sox in Boston. So again, we have our identity connected with our sport teams. The point is, then there are identities connected with our relationships. We simultaneously have our identity as a son or a daughter or a husband or a wife or a father or a mother. Simultaneously, we're juggling it. So when we are at home with the spouse, we have the identity of a spouse. When we are dealing with our children, I have an identity of a parent. When I'm dealing with my parents, I have an identity of a son or a daughter. So continually in life, we are kind of juggling with these multiple identities we have. And at some point, we need to ask ourselves, which of these identities is the real me? Some of these identities, of course, we lose over time. For instance, when we were little babies, I'm a baby identity. But obviously, when we grow up, we are no more babies. So that baby identity is discarded. And we have, there are certain identities we retain all through life. Certain identities are kind of more in our control. Like I may be a Republican now and then I get disgusted and say, I'm throwing away that identity, I become a Democrat. So certain identities I can change at my will. Certain identities I cannot change. But the question still remains. All these identities are changeable, fluctuating, which have a periodic value. Do I have any identity which is permanent? Do I have any identity which never changes? With time, with place? And what we are taught is that that identity is the identity of our relationship with God. That doesn't change. If I see myself as a child of God, I'm a child of God no matter what. No matter which place of the world I am in, or no matter what other identities I have, I'll continue to be a child of God. Or if I see myself as the spiritual self, as the Atman, then that never changes. As the spirit, as the soul, my identity doesn't change. And what we are asked to do here, when it is said, always be aware that you are Brahman, means always the more I hold on to my permanent identity, the more free I become from all the limitations I have. Because once I see myself as a child of God, anything that connects me with God frees me from all the limitations. The more my identity is connected with the body, of course, then all the limitations of the body are upon me. If the body is sick, I feel I am sick. The body is always the anxiety about the death. And say, oh my God, I will die one day. But if I have the identity, I'm a child of God. And of course, and God's children don't die. It's the body that perishes. The Atman never perishes. So the more we remind ourselves of our permanent identity, the free we become from all these other anxieties and stress and fears that we have in life. And completely give up all egoism. Egoism, you see, just this morning we were in Des Moines to meet with a few friends, and they have a baby was born on 12th of March, who is even less than 2 weeks old. And it was a wonderful visit this morning. And there I was mentioning that we were, of course, I'm not speaking about only one particular baby. All of us, when we were born, we were all babies. So this is the story of all of us. After we were born, or after a baby is born, for first few days or weeks, I don't remember the exact number, the baby doesn't have the idea of I. The baby does not have the notion of where its body ends and the rest of the world begins. It's one continuous whole for the baby. And it takes a while for the baby to realize its individuality. It takes a while for the baby to get the sense of I. And it is said that there is one professor of psychology, when a baby was born at his home, the first time the baby uttered the pronoun I, he gave a big party to all his friends. Because the realization of I, the sense of I, is a big turning point in the life of every individual. Because the moment you realize I am this person, I as a person is a very revolutionary discovery in life. It's also a frightening discovery, because until that point, everything was just one. But the moment you realize I am a person, what it does, the knowledge of I comes along with the knowledge of not I. The moment I know I am this, I immediately realize I am not all this. And the problem is, this I is so small, and this not I, this whole world which I am not, is so huge, is so big. It's frightening. Because I am so tiny, my power is limited, and this whole big universe, which is not me, it has forces, it has power which I can't control. And so the problem of human existence really begins with this experience that I am somebody. And this not I world is so huge. And it's a big, and that is what really is the source of egoism. Egoism means separating myself from the rest of creation. And no separation is joyful. It's always a very painful experience. And as long as we keep on emphasizing on this I, what we are essentially emphasizing is this whole universe is not me. And the universe is always more powerful than one individual. And therefore, we feel vulnerable, we feel weak, we feel helpless, because this not I is just too powerful. That is what focusing on egoism does to us. Eliminate the thought of I connected with the body, because it's the thought connected with the body will limit me, will bring all the anxieties and stress connected with the body into me. And don't argue with the wise ones. So don't argue with me if I tell you something. Okay, so I think I've spoken enough. So now if you have any thoughts or comments or questions, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm wondering, this seeking the company of the holy ones, remaining in their company, does this apply to my fellow members of the Vedanta Society of Iowa, or is it just the likes of them?
What? It just applies to anyone. Anyone whose company helps you remind yourself of your spiritual ideal. If you feel uplifted in the company of other people, if you feel stronger, if you feel closer to your spiritual ideal, then by all means seek that company. It can be anybody. But there could be some company, kind of company, which make you forget your spiritual ideal. Then that's no helpful. So that's the idea. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yesterday we talked about being self. That means wherever you are, be yourself. But today we talk about self-restraining. How can we be ourselves and restrain ourselves at the same time too? I don't know. Maybe I'm confusing you.
No, it's not clear. No.
Yesterday we talked about wherever you go, be yourself.
Wait a minute. When I say be yourself means be the self, the spirit.
That's right.
Yeah.
Today we did talk about self-restraining.
Yeah, so the problem here is because the same word self is used.
Okay.
So self-restraint here means, you see, it's like this. It's not that we don't have the idea of self now. We all have the idea of self. But our idea of self is, let me put it this way. When I say that I'm a human being, my idea of self is this body. When I say I'm happy or miserable, my idea of self is the mind. When I say I'm the infinite, immortal, perfect being, then my idea of the self is the Atman. Now, I'm using the word self for all of these. So when we speak about self-restraint, it means restraining the false self so that the real self will manifest itself. Yeah.
Want to say something?
I was thinking that when you said that a child has to learn the concept of I.
No, it doesn't have to learn. It comes.
It comes to him. And comes perhaps more for protection of his own body. How can we... right from that age, from the childhood, inculcate what kind of values that he never learns, that he is this limited I, keep him unlimited throughout.
Well, the first thing, in order to teach the child, the parents must feel that way. You see, if the parents feel, oh, I'm just a limited person, then how can you teach the child you are unlimited? You see, because oftentimes we impart to our children what we believe to be true. What are our own values we to children? So I think the first, parents will have to remind themselves, yes, I have an eternal relationship with God. I'm connected with God. When those thoughts and that identity is strong in my mind, then automatically what I teach my children will reflect that. So it's what we teach our children is not a matter of strategy. It's not a policy. It's what we believe to be true, we teach our children. In fact, there is a story of one Queen Madalasa in Indian mythology. And so she was an enlightened queen. So when it is said, when her children were born, while she was rocking the children in the cradle, she used to sing, Tvam Shuddhosi, Nityosi, Buddhosi, which means you are the eternal one, you are the pure one, you are the shining one. Those are the kind of songs she would sing. And of course, little children, you might say, well, what would those little babies understand? They don't have to understand. They just listening to that, of course. And as the baby started growing, it slowly could understand the meaning of what is being said. And hearing that right from the childhood, they said each of those children, as they grew up, they became very spiritual, very holy. So I think that that's a great responsibility and also a great service we can do to our children. We love our children, we love our grandchildren, and oftentimes we think that the best way we can express our love to our children and grandchildren is give them whatever they want. They want more computer games, give them that. They want more videos, give them that. They want more this, give them that. Which is fine. I'm nothing against toys and everything, which is wonderful. But I also think that if we really want to do them a real act of favor, a real act of service, that would be from that young age, if we can give them some of these really life-giving ideas. And if they learn it at that age, it will be much, much easier for them than it has been for us. A lot of us are like, oh, after we grow up, then we haven't had, some of us have not had the opportunity to learn about this when we were young. And it's like teaching an old horse what to do, which is not that the old horse will not listen, but as it becomes difficult. When we are a little bit older, our ideas have been already formulated, and learning something new is not as difficult as unlearning what already we have learned. That's tough. Now, if we don't want our children and grandchildren to experience the same difficulty, so we'll have to then now force ourselves to learn this and then give it to the next generation at a younger age. And then perhaps you may not be even alive to see them. When they grow up, they'll be eternally grateful to you. That time, they may not so much remember what kind of toys you gave them or what kind of sweets you gave them to eat. That they won't remember. But they will remember, this is what my parents taught me. And this is how it is helping me in life. It's very true. And I can tell that from my own experience. I don't remember what toys my parents gave me or what, but I still remember the kind of prayers they taught me when I was a little boy. The kind of little things I remember when we were children. Every day when we came from school, and then of course we went out to play and we returned from play, we all had to go. Well, I and my brother, there are two of us, and we had to go. We wash our hands and feet, and my parents had taught me, we had a small family shrine, we would go. With folded hand, we'll say our prayers, we'll go and touch the feet of my parent every day, in the morning and evening. It's not that it's being done in every Indian family. It was pretty unusual even in that time, because I knew that some of my cousins and others, they never did it. In fact, my uncles used to tell them, see how they are doing, why don't you do it?
Yeah.
So, but that's what I remember today, years, decades later, and I can never be more grateful to my parents for having taught me that. So something has to be said about what children remember when they grow up. So if we are able to give our children and grandchildren something more solid, which will, when they grow up and they have to face the kind of challenges we face, and they remember, this is what my mom taught me, this is what my dad taught me, and now I am able to face these challenges, they will be eternally grateful to you. And that's the greatest service we can do to the children. Any other ideas?
I have a question. It will sound very judgmental, and that's why I'm hesitating. I mean, you know, whatever you've talked about today at Vedanta is like, you know, self-control and self-realization. But, you know, the question I have is, when people get together for satsangs or temples or whatever the case may be, or, you know, in some people's houses, they'll do puja once a year, satyanarayan puja, whatever. You know, while the thing is going on, everybody feels holy and everybody immediately after that is in a very giving mood and happy and wants to help and all that. But a few days later, a few weeks later, I mean, the whole, it all just falls apart. Everybody's, including mine. And, you know, so, you know, one of my friends, every Friday, this is the third year we have been doing Bhagavad Gita. And so one of my friends, you know, she has said on a few occasions, what is the point of doing this if we don't change? But in that small group that meets, we have all seen and we discussed that, yes, it's affecting us. Yes, you know, we are changing. Yes, the way we react is changing a bit. At least we hope it is. But, you know, it just takes so long. And, you know, I just wonder how the change will come about. I mean, you know, the satsangs are going on and so on, but how does the community, you know, I mean, has a
It always has to be individual. You can't be just agonizing over the fact that others are not changing, and everybody has to change. Whether others change or not is not in your hands. But how much change you want to change yourself, that's completely in your hands. It's not a question of a community or anything. It's if I want to change, if I study something and if it makes sense, then if I'm not able to put into practice, it's my fault. It's nobody else's fault. And if I feel bad about it, then I must put greater effort to change myself. And if to the extent I'm able to change myself really and genuinely, I'll be able to help other people also. Because then when others, your friends see, oh, you see that change, and if it's, no, obviously clear, if it's a change for the better, then they're going to say, wonderful. And if people see that as a result of that change, you are more calm, you are more peaceful, you feel more in control of yourself, you feel more in a frame of mind where you are able to take the right kind of decisions in life, of course everybody would want to say, you become an inspiration then in your own right. And then it inspires other people then to make greater effort to change. So we all have to just look at our own selves and see how seriously we take what we study. So whether it's Satyanarayan Puja or it is this weekly study, it's not something as a kind of a, see, spiritual activities such as even puja or satsang can become a kind of entertainment. You see, so instead of going for a weekly game of a baseball or a basketball, we say, okay, now let's study the Gita. Because just like a weekly game of a tennis or something can bring some joy, this brings us some joy. But, you know, that's nothing unless it brings about some kind of a lasting transformation in me. And again, that's again entirely in the hands of each of us. We can change if we want to, and if you're not serious about it, we will not change. So there's nothing wrong in the book itself. It's in our willpower, determination to do it.
So like this individual, you know, who asks, it's not changing us, so why even bother to attend? And this is a very serious group. They just we just come, we read and we are done. And no, after that there's no conversation or tea or whatever. So, you know, how long should an individual give himself or herself to feel that, or how does one realize that, yeah, it is really having an impact on me?
Well, if there is a genuine change, we will know ourselves. And I don't believe that if we make a very serious effort to change, that nothing will happen, unless there is something intrinsically wrong in the Gita itself. But But seeing that other people who have tried to follow it, it has changed them, it would be difficult to say that the book is different. If no one's life had been transformed as a result of the Gita, then of course we could have rejected the Gita, because if it said, if there was some truth in it, after 3,000 years, at least some people should have been changed. But we're seeing that some people's lives have been completely transformed. We at least know that the book is not at fault. And so we just have to try harder. Change really, you see, oftentimes what happens is this. When we speak about change, we are all, many of times, we are just looking at a very dramatic changes in our lives. It doesn't have to be a very dramatic change. Change, I think small steps are always helpful. The change, it may not be a change like immediately everybody will notice, ah, you have changed. It doesn't have to be that dramatic. It could be in a very tiny little microscopic changes in our lives. And therefore one has to be always vigilant that something small happens and then you find yourself responding to it, reacting to it. And if you have been reacting to it exactly the way you were reacting years ago, in spite of the study of the Gita, then of course it has not changed. But if you find now that you are reacting to that in a slightly different way, and then you say, wait a minute, before I started studying the Gita, this was not how I responded. Now I'm responding in a different way. Obviously, no, you are changing a little bit. So these changes sometimes can be so subtle that we ourselves may not be aware of it. But it's always good to kind of be aware of what's going on inside. What's the point in leading mechanical lives? I think. Yeah.
I mean, all the psychologists and counselors, they always say, when somebody has, they don't like their boss or something, just get a paper and write it down, like what you don't like about your boss and all those things. But our teachings here say that even don't talk about like being angry and being not liking your boss, and is it right today? So we are not supposed to even, you are saying that we are not even supposed to get any bad thoughts, and suppose we don't like the boss we are working with, the psychologists say, okay, write it down in a paper, that's what you did not like about your boss.
And show it to him or don't show it to him?
By writing it down, all those facts in the
brain. While writing, it may not go away, just kind of relieve the pent up tension in you. I mean, sometimes they say just go and do some punching your pillow at home. You feel like beating somebody, instead of beating that person, go and punch your pillow. Now what it really does is, it's not really eliminating the seeds of anger from your heart. But if you go and punch that person, then that person will hit back and it may get worse. You punch a pillow, the pillow won't hit back. So in a way you have eliminated a crisis, a potential crisis. But you're not really solved the problem. The seed of anger is still there. You are just venting it on a pillow. So if you want to really eliminate the problem, not just eliminate the crisis, is to know what to do with those seeds of anger, because I may have kind of pushed them back in my subconscious, but they haven't really gone. So what these methods do is go to the root of the problem, not just deal with the symptoms. Yeah.
My kids who are born here and growing up here, sometimes they ask me, I ask them in the morning, pray to Ma Kaliyo. So they every day, and then at the end of the day, my son comes home, I said, and he tells me that he asked something to Ma Kaliyo to give it to him, and it didn't happen. I said, I will never going to ask her anything in future. You know, it's, I understand why it didn't happen or anything, but a child, he doesn't understand what's happening, and he said, oh, she never listens to me or something like that, and he's definitely frustrated on that, you know, since it didn't happen that day. But next day he does it again. But what should I answer in that case?
Well, you can tell him Ma Kali is not an ATM machine.
but
it just depends on how we teach our children to relate themselves to God, you know. Oh, if I ask something to God and God gives it to me, then I'm going to pray. You know, they say, no, it's not like God is at your beck and call. You say, oh, only if you, God, you know. So again, how you present the reality of God to the children, so that the child should not feel that, oh, if I pray and if I, the difficulty is this, and I can understand the real challenges that parents can face. I mean, if you are the only influence on the child, then you can have probably greater control over the child. But that's not what's happening. A child goes to school,
friends,
and there are friends. He hears from other friends and maybe sees some television programs. So the ideas and thoughts are coming from so many different sides. And those thoughts and ideas may not be exactly the thoughts of ideas you may want to impart to the child. So it really becomes a challenge, first of all, to try to eliminate those thoughts and try to share what you feel about it. There is no easy solution to that, except that if you can impart your vision to the child in such a way that the influence of other sources might not be as effective as your influence, which it is tough, but we just have to try. Yeah, it is tough. That's it. Okay, so we will then conclude today, and so tomorrow evening we will do the next two verses, 4 and 5, and that will conclude this hymn. In the next two verses there are important themes that are discussed here about our attitude towards food, our attitude towards the changing nature of life, and of course what is the best way to continue doing our spiritual practice